Good afternoon. Welcome to meeting number 195. Is that correct, Jane?
Yes.
Of the UAF Faculty Senate. Jane, would you please call the roll?
Albertson.
Present.
I think I heard you online. Are you online, Leif?
I am online, yes.
Thank you. Baker.
Andrew McDonald in for Tory.
Thank you. Andrew's here for Tory. Barnes.
Here.
Bergie. I heard somebody. Okay. Bret Hart. Anybody here for Donnie Bret Hart? C. Okay, thank you. Chen. Anybody attending for Cheng Fu? Kaufman.
Here.
Cook. Condi. Anyone attending for Mark Condi? Davis. Dean. Anyone attending for John Dean? Duke. Anyone attending for Rob Duke? Oh, here we got some folks coming in. Yeah, and Mark Condi. One second. Fallon. Foce Sato.
Here.
Gibson.
Here.
Gustafson.
Here.
Han. Anyone attending for Chow Chi Han? Hardy.
Here.
Healy. Osman.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Johnston.
Here.
Jolly. Anyone attending for Julie? Keeland.
Here.
Barden.
Here.
Lovecraft. She'll be running late.
That's right.
Marr.
On the phone.
Thank you. McCartney.
Here.
Meyer. Anyone attending for Franz Meyer? Misra. Moser.
Here.
Newberry.
Here.
Radenbaugh.
Yes, I'm present.
Shellcroft.
Here. Well, not really here, but I'm here in Anchorage.
Thank you. Short.
Replacing.
Okay, Falk is here for Margaret. Valentine.
Here.
Weber.
Here.
Webley.
Here.
Winfrey. Windsor.
Here.
Yari.
Here.
Zhang.
Mark here.
Thank you. And I'll recognize our ex officio members. We have our provost here. I don't see our chancellor yet. We'll keep an eye out. We have Mike Ernest and Katie Oring here. Libby's in Anchorage. Brad Crick, are you here? Okay, for staff council. Is anyone here for ASUAF today? Okay, I heard rumors that we might have someone. Thanks. Anyone from athletic? And we have Dean Herman. Dean Herman is here. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jane. And before we do anything else, I wanted to pass along a comment that Jane asked me to, which is you'll note that the setup is a little bit different today than it's been. We have kind of this big horseshoe shape. We're getting more creative, I guess. And the two diagonal tables over there and over there, microphones on them. So if you're seated at one of those, feel free to wrestle the microphone away from the nearest person to you. And people that are at the adjacent tables, please relinquish them if your neighbors need to make a comment. Okay. The next item is approval of minutes to last month's meeting, meeting number 194.
So moved.
Okay. We have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any opposition to any concerns or amendments to the minutes from last month? Okay. Without objection, the minutes are approved. And today's agenda. Motion to adopt today's agenda, please. Somebody. Thank you. Okay. And second somewhere. Okay, thank you. And anybody see anything on the agenda that they would like to add, or not see something on the agenda they would like to add or modify? Okay, so without objection, we'll proceed with the agenda as printed. We have several items that were approved by the Chancellor, so all of the items that we have passed have been approved by the Chancellor. We received a memo from the Chancellor concerning one of the motions that we've passed. I'm going to read it to you. I'm signing the motion passed at meeting number 194 on November 4, 2013, but want to make you aware of a policy change that the Board of Regents will soon consider. The motion states the Faculty Senate moves to amend the 2014 to 2015 catalog to reflect a new mathematics and developmental mathematics placement policy as indicated below. The President's Cabinet has discussed the value of a single mathematics and developmental mathematics placement policy throughout the University of Alaska system. I expect the President and the Board of Regents to take action on a uniform policy to be effective by 2016. This will require the UAF Faculty Senate to work with your counterparts to determine the best placement process. I, Chancellor Rogers, am fully supportive of the direction you are taking and subject to seeing the results at UAF consistent with those at other institutions, will push for system-wide adoption of ALEX PPL. If the Board, however, establishes a policy of a single set of system-wide placement steps and cut scores, all three universities will need to comply. That may require UAF faculty to accommodate differing viewpoints of the UAA and UAS faculty. The Chancellor's bottom line is that he likes the motion that we passed last month. He supports it, but he wants us to be aware of the fact that potential changes at the statewide level may wind up mandating that we will have to change in a couple of years. So we'll have to keep our eye out on that. Hopefully, the other universities in the system will adopt our way of doing things because it's better, but we'll have to see. Okay, next up are my remarks. I guess that counted as one of my remarks. Oh, yes, go ahead.
So from the Chancellor's memo, I understand that statewide can change anything they want to without the faculty's input, or what?
No, I don't believe that that's the case. I believe that what he's saying is that in the future, the Board of Regents may be, and the President may be asking all three universities to adopt a common set of mathematics cut scores and methodology, and there will be opportunity for input on the by the faculty on that, but it's not necessarily. It won't necessarily be that ours will hold sway through all that. Okay. Okay. Some brief remarks. I hope. One is that the as you may be aware, the provost has asked or has decided that the two of the units within UAF will become a common unit, the School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences and the Cooperative Extension Service. I wanted to update you on that. There was a committee that was formed with Faculty Senate representation in the form of Donnie Bretthart. And that committee met a lot during the fall. I was also on the committee. and formed a report that went to the provost for her consideration. It consisted of a series of recommendations concerning the makeup, the administrative structure that it recommended for the new unit. The provost is considering that and will in the near term. At the time that we presented the report, it was about a month out, I think, and we're nearing the end of that month. So she'll be making her decision shortly concerning what the administrative structure of that unit will be. You may be aware that there has been proposed at the Board of Regents a modification to the tuition benefit that UA employees enjoy. That's us, staff, and so forth. The Board of Regents considered a proposal at its last meeting that would cut that benefit essentially in half. So instead of employees and their benefits receiving free tuition, they would receive a benefit of half free tuition. So I guess that's cheap tuition. And that motion was voted on by the Board of Regents and failed by a tie vote at the time. So this is a potential loss for UA, not just UAF, but UA employees that the Board of Regents is considering and is considering it fairly quickly. There is a survey that we've all received an email about seeking UA employee input into that process, asking whether, you know, what importance it is and of what value it is and whatever else we want to tell them about it. I would urge you to fill out that survey and have your voice be heard. I would further urge you to take advantage of the public comments portion of the next Board of Regents meeting, especially if you have a personal story that tells how important that is to you, or if you know someone who has a similar story. Apparently, that is something that the Board of Regents need to hear. So, I would suggest that you do that. Of somewhat broad concern it was brought to my attention that there is some problems associated with purchasing equipment, replacement equipment for laboratories, and that there isn't an established system here. We've asked the Research Advisory Committee to look into developing a system for not only pursuing major research infrastructure, but also for replacing mid-level equipment, maybe in the range of $20,000 to $100,000 in range, which are a little bit hard to write into regular research proposals. So I wanted to let you know that somebody is working on that. I can't read my own notes. I'm moving on. As you may be aware, we have a late deadline this year for turning in grades before the winter break. As of the last time I heard, and maybe somebody can update me on this, but UA Online is scheduled to be down on December 22nd. So that may interfere with plans to submit grades or do whatever you're planning to do on the 22nd. So please be aware that that's scheduled. You were going to say something about that? Go ahead, Susan.
I don't have a lot to add except that Libby has been in communication with Statewide. She has requested that there be a, first of all, that they limit the outage on the 22nd to the very shortest period possible, and that they have it in the early morning hours, preferably when few faculty members will be awake and wanting to submit their grades. So we haven't heard back, though. Libby has not heard back yet on the final decision on when the outage will be. When there is a final word from Statewide on that, it will be communicated widely to everyone, the timing and duration of the outage, and then we hope that that will enable you to plan ahead and not be inconvenienced by the outage.
Thank you, Susan. Last item I have is that last spring we commissioned a committee, more or less a task force, an ad hoc committee, to look at barriers, hurdles, problems in working interdisciplinarily. We have received the report of that committee. It will be posted online. And we are now considering how best to move forward with the committee's identification of problems and recommendations of potential issues, potential pathways forward. So if you have any particular interest in that, I would certainly appreciate your input. And with that, I will relinquish the microphone to Cecile for her comments.
Just one item. In addition to the statewide strategic planning, UAF also needs to update its strategic plan, which is linked to the accreditation process. So it's a somewhat different process and somewhat different goal. The provost and chancellor approached us about how we wanted to have input on that, and we discussed it at the Senate Admin Committee. And so what we thought would be the best process was to have the current plan online. And Jane, the link is already up, right?
I have it ready to go.
Okay. So it will be up shortly. So they're linked to the current UAS strategic plan, and we invite your input to that. And then the cabinet will look at that input and make whatever alterations they consider necessary or good to make, and we'll bring that back to the Senate for approval. So that's the process we sort of came to that seemed efficient and still allowed for a good amount of input. So please, as soon as Jane has that up, she will make an announcement, right? That it's up. So, you know, it's not going to be the most exciting reading, but please do read it and do provide some input on it. And, you know, of course, the more professional, the more likely it will be incorporated. So that's really all I have to say. I FYI, I may need to stand up during the meeting. I have an inflamed nerve in my leg, so I can't sit for long. So I'm probably going to stand up and sort of pace around a little bit. So don't be disturbed by that.
Yeah, actually, on two personal notes. So Cecile is dealing with some real bad back pain, and I went to the eye doctor this morning. I'm dilated, so I can hardly see a thing. So we're really kind of limping along here. I can't read my own notes, even if they're typed. We're moving on now. The chancellor's not here. Why don't we go ahead and ask the provost for her remarks, and we'll ask the chancellor to comment when he arrives.
Okay. This always risks me overlapping with the chancellor's remarks because not having heard what he's going to say in advance, and he doesn't hear me. So please bear with us if we end up repeating ourselves. One of the things that I was going to talk about was the UA online issue, but that's been covered already. I want to amplify a little bit about the strategic planning and its relationship to accreditation. The accrediting body, Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, has a policy that universities need to engage in an inclusive strategic planning process. This may be, for some of you who are relatively new, the first you've heard of the strategic planning process, but it's really been going on here for about 2 years. The draft that you will see on the website was the product of a committee that included both faculty, staff, and administrators, three groups. And that strategic planning committee met for many months and produced the draft. In the course of their work, they had a survey that was distributed widely across the university that offered people the opportunity for input. So we're reaching a culminating stage in this process. We're not right at the beginning. All that said, of course, we do solicit your comments and want you to look at the strategic plan as it is presented on the website and make important suggestions for improvement. We do want this to be a strategic plan that is embraced by the community, the campus community as a whole. The strategic plan is, according to the accreditation process, supposed to be actually the first step in a process that leads to core themes, objectives, and indicators. But because the accreditation cycle was truncated for us last time, we didn't do things quite in the ordinary order. We expect to get back to this sort of order as we enter into the next accreditation cycle. But at least, even though we've done things a little bit out of order, at least the accreditors expect to see alignment between our strategic plan, our core themes, and our indicators. And the Strategic Planning Committee was conscious of that and did work hard to make sure that there was that kind of alignment. The accreditors would also like to see alignment between our strategic plan and planning at the system level if we're part of a system, as we are. That's one of the reasons for the delay in bringing this strategic plan draft to the Faculty Senate for final approval, is in that we were hoping that the Strategic Directions Initiative, or now called the Shaping Alaska's Future process, would be concluded so that we could work on constructing an alignment between what we need to produce for accreditation, that is the strategic plan, the core themes and the indicators, and the Shaping Alaska Futures document. But it seems that that final document is going to be delayed. The good news is that at this point we probably have some fairly clear idea of the issues that that document is going to address, and we can work out, I think, enough of a narrative within our accreditation documents to show that we are indeed aligned thoroughly from top to bottom in all of our planning processes. So we're looking forward, especially Alex Fitz, my vice provost, who's working on our year 3 accreditation report, is looking forward, we hope, to a prompt and thorough consideration of this strategic plan by the Faculty Senate. She needs to have the year 3 report to our accrediting group done by the end of this academic year. And that means that, of course, she needs to, she hopes, work from a finalized strategic plan here by about mid-semester. So we don't want to, you know, require or ask for undue haste, but we are hoping for prompt and thorough attention. I think I'll stop there, again, to avoid overlap with the Chancellor and let him go to his remarks. The only thing that I covered was the strategic planning process, so you can feel free to talk about other.
The next couple of weeks are going to be significant in terms of what the future looks like to us with first, day after tomorrow, the state revenue projections will come out. The governor's budget is due out by the end of next week. We also have a Board of Regents meeting next week. And clearly, fiscal issues will play a part if the governor has announced his budget before the board comes in. We don't know if that'll be the case. He actually has until Sunday the 15th to release his budget. The board meeting is here in Fairbanks. Would encourage faculty who have any issues you want to bring to the board to take advantage of the opportunity for public comment. We have both this meeting and the next meeting will be in Fairbanks, and then we don't have any for quite some time. Due to just a switch in dates, we ended up with two of the major board meetings in a row. There is a motion pending, essentially held over from the last meeting, brought forward by one board member to reduce the tuition waiver benefit by half from the current tuition waiver benefit. I would encourage any who are seeking to testify on that, if you have those who have specific personal stories to tell about impact on family, what it's meant to you or for your staff, what it's meant to them to have that benefit, to speak to the board. I think it's really important that the board understand how important it is as an educational institution to say we believe in educating our faculty and our staff and creating opportunities that make us competitive with other universities. But language from me about competitiveness and recruitment and retention are not going to carry as much weight as specific stories by faculty members and staff who have used the benefit. And I know there are staff who have who've moved up through the ranks because they have gotten a baccalaureate degree or a master's degree, or they've taken courses. And I think that's an important message to get to the board in order to preserve what I think is a really critical benefit for us as a university. There are a couple mentions earlier in terms of trying to align some of our student processes. This is really coming out of the Shaping Alaska's Future, formerly SDI, process. The president and the chancellors have been looking at particularly the student-facing processes. What can we do that makes it simpler for students? I've been working really hard to make sure that any changes that really are the prerogative of the Faculty Senate or Senates to decide, that they stay in that and not be any overrides. But I would expect some pushing, and maybe appropriately so, for the three Senates to get together on some issues that affect students who are crossing boundaries between the three universities. And certainly you've been doing that on the general education learning outcomes. And as I've said at several previous meetings, really applaud the leadership of this Senate in that area. I think we'll see some other areas that comes forward as well. We don't know what's going to come out of the revenue projections on Wednesday, but I don't expect it to be good news. Looking at the price of oil and production, we're likely to see a very tight budget for the coming fiscal year, and that calls on us to continue to look for opportunities for reducing our costs where we can. And so, to the extent that we can, we continue to work on the issue of reducing our leased space, reducing our heating and lighting and electrical costs, those things that don't have a direct impact on the people. We deliver our mission through people, and so that's the last place I want to go to effectuate savings. But that really means all of us in our behavior and use of electrical, every electrical piece of electronic equipment we have, but also if you see areas that you think we can make reductions, please feel free to let us know, let department chairs, let deans know where we can find additional savings where we can. And with that, again, I think Susan and I can answer any questions that members of the Senate may have.
I have a question. For the Shaping Alaska's Future,
document that came out, do you recommend that people comment on that at the board meeting or hold off until the next draft is out?
I would hold off on that until the next meeting. I'm not sure that the board has seen that and read it. I think it was really a work in progress as it went out. Hopefully everybody in the Senate received the UAF overall comments, and I expect to see a fair bit of that incorporated in the next draft. And I don't think it will go to the board at all until after the next draft, comments on the next draft, and then a version might go to the board. That's my hope.
Okay.
With regard to saving energy, how many buildings like Irving are there where there are no light switches?
There are too many, is the answer. And as we go through doing modifications to buildings, moving to the proximity sensor lights is one of the things that we've been doing as we can. But each one of those, you really doing it by itself is a significant cost. So you try to do it when you're doing the other deferred maintenance. And on the West Ridge in particular, we have four related projects, LV, Irving, Arctic Health, and O'Neill, all of which have a significant maintenance component. And in the course of going through and doing the other modifications to heating, ventilating, air conditioning, to building envelope, et cetera, that's when those would be done. They really cry out for that. Usually what we do first is variable speed motors in the heating and ventilating, then look at freezers, and lighting is the last. But we've gone through auditing buildings to see where the best payoff is for investments that we can make. We did about $6 million last year. We'll probably do an equivalent amount in the next 2 years in terms of doing those kind of improvements, focusing on electrical energy. But O'Neill is a problem. Butrovich, you know, basically if there's anybody in there, the whole floor is lit. There are a number in that circumstance. This building has some problems, so we've got a long way to go on them.
But heating was actually my next question, too. So I was kind of wondering about the cost benefit of having heaters in your office versus actually having the office heated. Because right now I'm working at 54 degrees in my office, and you probably too, so Andrew too. So yeah, we have all.
So getting heat balance right is some using the steam heating system has a high payoff because we avoid those high electrical uses at our peak load. Yes, and that is a ongoing and significant problem, again, particularly in the late 60s, early 70s buildings, which is, you know, the average age of building at UAF is 36 years. It's most of our buildings were built in an era before the kinds of controls that work. So it's, you know, West Ridge altogether is going to be a $400 million plus project over 15, 20 years in order to do all the things we need to do to bring those buildings up. So one at a time, working our way through. O'Neill is one of the biggest problems that we have, and really, as we look at the at the West Ridge, one of our big questions is that one of the buildings that comes down when all is said and done? And you know, when we renovate, if we renovate O'Neill, it will not be a wet lab building. It just is not. Trying to retrofit it for wet labs won't work. We'll need to build new wet labs first in order to move people out into appropriate spaces. And exactly what we have a plan that's gone to the board that they've seen for West Ridge that has a whole series of moves over time. Because the other piece that's really important from my perspective is I don't want to move research scientists more than once if we can avoid it, because every time we move, there's a disruption to the research enterprise. And that costs... What?
And we lose one of them.
Well, and we may lose more than one, unfortunately. So to the extent that we can minimize the amount of disruption to the research enterprise, that's a major major point in the logistics of doing all of the transfers on West Ridge.
Can I just quickly follow up on this? I have actually two questions and along the same line. One is about the car heaters. I think it's possible over the Christmas times to have a student can park a car there for 3 weeks and have it 24 hours fully heated. I wonder if that has ever been considered as part of the equation. But my real question is, if we do all the energy savings, does the money really come back to the faculty or to the university pool? Like, I think we're saving a lot of money with the heating questions, but where does the money really go, and do we really see the outcome of that?
So the answer is that's there's a complex answer. Some of it is in avoided costs of increase going forward. A piece of it, I mentioned the $6 million worth of improvements that we made. We're going to save about $500,000 a year on those. That $6 million. That's going to pay the debt service because we borrowed the $6 million. So early on, essentially, we're converting from heating costs to debt service costs, and the savings come out of ways. In the long run, money is fungible, and so if we don't have savings on energy conservation, then we're going to have to rob other places to pay for heat. We're also looking at taking some buildings down. At Tilley Commons, we haven't made a final decision, but once we move all the food service up here, it's questionable whether Tilley Commons is worth keeping. And to the extent we can reduce some of the buildings, that's a saving. As for plug-ins, most of our lots are on a cycle time, so it's on and then off and then on and then off, and they're offset with each other to lower the total demand at any given time. Although most, and I forget the exact cycle, but almost all of them are on full time from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., so you know when you plug it in, it's working, and then it goes, then it cycles through the day, and then on again when students show up for evening class.
Okay. I saw Debu's hand up. Oh, sorry.
Yes. I just wanted to bring up a couple of points, and since I also wear another hat, I'm kind of in between right now. Let me thank David Valentine for bringing up the issue of reduction of tuition waiver and encouraging faculty to fill out the email that went out from HR, Erica Van Flynn. And I would urge everybody to fill that out and send it to your constituencies, because I sent an email to somebody and they said that they have deleted it already. So there is a problem there, okay? The more response we send, the better. But also we are in negotiations, and two things can happen. In the negotiations, if we even get the tuition benefit intact, the Board of Regents can still vote against it. So the ratification process is there. You know, we can vote in favor of the contract, but again, it has to be ratified by the Board of Regents on the other side. And they might say, well, you didn't put our tuition waiver reduction in there. So it's critical that we also keep a line with the negotiation team, which is Tony Ricard from Mathematics Department. If most of you send emails or talk to him about retaining this benefit, then they will go into the table more equipped. Third thing is, I appreciate Chancellor Rogers' comment about people going and actually being present at the Board of Regents meeting and making each of the Board of Regents aware, and I thank you for that, Chancellor, aware that it's a very critical thing, not only for faculty, because, you know, we are probably safeguarded by our CBA, but the staff is going to lose it if this comes through. And it's a problem for the staff. If we lose staff tomorrow, the faculty is nowhere. And we need to support our staff also in this. So they do an incredible job. I mean, I have seen one admin taking care of 8 to 10 faculty members. And if we lose that one admin just because of this loss of benefit, then that's a big problem. So we need to really safeguard our staff. Okay. And also UAFT, I don't know when they are going to go into the negotiations and other stuff, but that is another issue that will come up. So we need to return the benefit at any cost. And I'll urge all the senators, if possible, to go next week, be available during the public comments and make the senators, Board of Regents aware that this is very critical to the faculty and the staff and the health of the institute. Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. That's an excellent comment about the staff, that they are in a more precarious position than we are right now with respect to that. Thank you. Laura?
One more comment about the energy, and so I was just wondering how this ends up in statistics that the university is using. For example, is it something that, you know, all of a sudden, like, ooh, look at Vestrid, you know, all those damn scientists up there are hogging up all the power, or is it actually considered that we are sitting in the oldest building?
I've not heard that you're all hogging the power. We do have online. You can look at, for many of our buildings, at what the current daily, the weekly energy, water, and heating use is building by building, and how it changes over time. But I don't think there's been any. Anything looking at the challenge of higher use because of inefficient buildings. I think it's our job as the administration to try to bring the inefficiency down by attacking the most problem buildings first. And I don't see that at all as a reflection on faculty. Now, people who are using old freezers that might be able to use newer ones at lower cost, if we could do that, we'd like to switch some out. Freezers and heaters are among our top energy uses after heating and ventilating. And so,
is there a pot of money for freezer exchange?
If it pays off, yes, we can finance. You know, in other words, if the savings on energy costs cover the difference, and in many cases it may, we've got a source of funding to do that. So if you've got some freezers you want to change out, you know, let facilities know that you think you've got an inefficient one and that an efficient one might pay off. And if so, I think there's an opportunity there. I've urged facilities to look at that area wherever they see groups of freezers that might have that opportunity. We know that energy savings will pay off on that kind of electrical use. So right now we're essentially paying Golden Valley, because we buy peak electricity from Golden Valley, we're paying them at 20 cents plus per kW. for energy use, and that bill adds up fast.
Okay, any other questions for either the Chancellor or the Provost at this point?
Actually, one comment I forgot to make, if I may. Okay, thank you. The Board of Regents need to know that our accreditation process involves lifelong learning. And by reducing the tuition to half and other stuff, they're actually coming in the way of the lifelong learning process. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Debu. I mentioned earlier I'm half blind right now, and I was able to decipher some of my notes, so I'm going to add a comment. I'm sorry. And that is that the General Education Revitalization Committee, which is the Subcommittee of Curricular Affairs Committee, of Faculty Senate Committee, and they have come up with a proposed revision to general education. And that revision is now available on the GERC website. They have a website. It's accessible through the Faculty Senate website. And they're looking for comments, both to what you see on the website, but also they're holding a series of public events to try to get faculty input into what they've proposed. So given the importance of general education, I would urge you to look into those public comment opportunities, go to their website, have a look. And that's happening, I don't remember the specific days, but it's happening this week. So please do that. Tuesday at IARC tomorrow, and then, oh, look
Friday
at this.
At the library.
Tuesday, December 3rd, 1 to 2 p.m., 401 IARC. Friday, December 6th, 2 to 3 p.m., Media Classroom, 340 Rasmussen Library. So this should be of fairly broad interest to all of us, since whether we are teaching core courses or whether we're teaching students that came out of core courses, this is of concern to us. So please learn about that, and please have your input. Okay. We are going to move now to our first and only discussion item. The Curricular Affairs Committee has drafted a motion that seeks to address some inconsistencies with respect to how we handle transfer of credits. And I'm going to ask Reiner if he'd please lead us in the discussion of this potential motion that we'll consider sometime in the future. Reiner?
Okay, this is a complicated issue, which is why instead of bringing this up as a motion at this time, we're bringing it up as a discussion item. Our objective is to discuss it, look at the pros and cons, eventually bring this up in some revised form for a future Faculty Senate meeting. Essentially, we have to be liberal about our interpretation of core courses when we allow when we accept transfer students from within the University of Alaska. That's because any person who takes a course in the University of Alaska which satisfies the core requirements at their particular version of University of Alaska satisfies them all. In contrast, we can be as illiberal or as
restrictive
as we want to about students who are transferring from non-UA institutions. Back when the core was instituted approximately 25 years ago, we were moderately restrictive in terms of accepting transfers, in particular for the Perspectives on Human Condition courses. About 8 years ago or so, the transfer conditions were made more restrictive. The current version is on page 3, I think. I had it out here a moment ago. Might be page 4 of what's allowed for, what's not allowed for. Oops, there it is. Yeah. Okay, so the current version is on page 4. If I can get you to look at the section, it's marked Perspectives on Human Condition, requirements for something which transfers as History 100X, for Econ Poli Sci 100X, for Ant Soc 100X, for English 200X, art music theater, and so on. These are fairly restrictive requirements with the idea that a student have if not exactly the same course as ours, at least something fairly similar. And again, in contrast, if a student goes to UAA, there's much less restrictiveness about what they have to do to pass these requirements. Essentially, they need to take a social science class in order to pass these requirements. So what's proposed is on page 5, okay, and page 6. In the very bottom of page 5, the suggested requirement for someone to transfer with a course that counts as History 100X, Econ Poli Sci 100X, and or Anthosh 100X are that they take 3 different social science classes of their choice. That for world literature, instead, it would be simply a course in the humanities, and that for art, music, theater, it would be a course in the arts. The obvious advantage to making the transfer requirements less rigid are that we would likely attract a greater number of transfer students for whom the courses they've already taken would count, and they wouldn't have to retake, essentially, a world history class instead of the American history class, which their school required. The obvious disadvantage is that we're not holding transfer students to the same criteria as we're holding our own students. There's clearly advantages and disadvantages. I urge you to comment, question, or otherwise discuss the issue.
And part of the issue, as I understand it, Reiner, is essentially, I'm going to coin a phrase here, a credit laundering potential here, which is where a student can get their credits transferred to, say, UAA under their system, and then that credit transfers here, but it would not transfer here directly.
Agreed.
Okay.
Yes, agreed.
Okay. Chris.
So how does all of this fit into the discussions pertaining to GERC? My understanding is that GERC is in the process of proposing revisions to our core requirements to turn it into a general education system, and I wonder if we pass something like this, how long it will be relevant, if the system is going to become more flexible soon anyway.
All depends on how quickly we pass GERC, eh?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the way that I see it, if it helps at all. I see the revision to general education as being on a kind of a separate track that we hope that it will eventually come to great fruition. But meanwhile, there's our current general education or our core curriculum that requires a certain degree of maintenance and upkeep over time. And it would be somewhat perilous to stop maintaining and updating the current core, hoping that GERC will finish and we'll have a wonderful new core curriculum or general education curriculum next year. Until such time as it's clear when that is actually going to happen, it only makes sense to me to do what revisions are necessary and what maintenance is necessary on our current core to keep it as relevant as possible. That's my answer. Others may have different answers.
Realistically, unless we have a new core curriculum in place so that it can be accepted at the March Faculty Senate meeting, it won't happen next year. So it's at least a year away.
Okay, Debu?
Yeah. The way I see it is this has nothing to do really with the change in core curriculum or anything. We are just saying, how do we map a course in our institute with somebody who is coming from outside? Is that my understanding, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, if so, I just have a quick question. On the table on page 5, where you say math 200, 201, 202, that's the second row, it will be substituted by a calculus or statistics course at the 100 level. Is that a slip? Or should it be 200 level?
There are schools where, like MIT, calculus is 100 level class.
I have a question also. Why is the math 161X included in the line above the one we were just talking about?
Yeah.
Could you repeat that, please? I didn't hear it.
Sorry?
Yeah, closer. Could you repeat your question, please, Jane?
Why is math 161X not in the with 107X and 103X?
I don't know.
It should be, I believe.
I'm guessing.
Well, what kind of struck me is math 107 will be replaced by 100 level, and math 200 will be replaced also by 100 level. Those are contradictory.
The key wording here is a calculus or statistics class. And calculus classes at different universities, sometimes they're 100 level and sometimes they're 200 level, but it has to be calculus.
Amy?
Ready. So is there any, it seems like the reason we're doing this is because we are experiencing credit laundering and we're trying to avoid it. Is that what this is being proposed for? I guess I don't really understand the purpose of liberalizing what we're requiring transfer students to take, because it would seem that with our focus on needing to fill seats to get money, we want students taking our courses. So is credit laundering actually happening? And B, if not, is there another reason why we're doing this?
Yeah. So your point's well taken. Okay. So there may well be a decrease, a small decrease in credit hour production if this happens. On the other hand, we feel that two likely outcomes are a greater number of transfer students would actually complete a degree, because there would be fewer classes that they would need to, quote, take over here, and they would be less discouraged about the whole process. The second point is that there would presumably be more transfer students here, because they would see that, oh, I don't have to take course X, Y, and Z over again. I can use the course I already have taken.
So I find that incredibly problematic without any data to back up either of those assertions. I mean, who transfers to UAS, right? People from Juneau or Anchorage, there's fluidity among the three institutions. We have people who transfer for sports, so they come in because of the scholarship, or they come through us from the military. I think those would probably be our three major pipelines, and one could correct me, but it seems like we'd want to know where they're coming from. Some of those, or I in my mind, just as a supposition, the majority of those individuals would be sort of captive individuals. In other words, they're not going to leave unless they are actually reassigned militarily or something else takes them away. I just don't see credit transfer hour issues driving those individuals away, except for maybe a narrow slice of students coming from the other, what we used to call MAUs. So
it obviously...
Hang on, Ryan.
Okay, all right, okay.
I'd like to... understand, I guess for me, I'd like to have some data that would make what you're saying believable to me. I feel like it's based on us guessing about transfers as opposed to having some statistics that give us some information about transfers. But maybe
so,
you have those and you just haven't mentioned it.
So Amy, I'm going to, Chancellor Rogers has asked me to have a chance to address your remarks.
Well, first, I think we should be prepared to provide some additional data on transfer students to the Senate, and we will do that. There is another significant population that you didn't mention, which is the Alaska student who goes outside and decides that he or she is paying too much for nothing more than they're getting here and comes back after a year. And I guess the question is, how many of them would choose UAA over UAS because it's easier to transfer into UAA? That's a concern. Do we have data on that? No.
I'd also point out the number of transfer students must vary considerably from department to department. Roughly half of the majors in geology are transfer students. They come here specifically because they want to come to UAF, and for many of them, it is a hardship taking over courses that they've more or less taken elsewhere.
I've been calling on people on this half of the room. I see a hand up over here.
And my question would also be, on what basis are we allowing or not allowing the transfer credits from other institutions? I think it's going to depend on the level of the institution. And you know, the way they number their courses, et cetera. Do we feel, I mean, in my department or program, it's always been done on, in part, on the proof that these students could show us that they, whatever classes they've had, meet whatever requirements we have to allow them to say transfer at least a non-core class, but a class in the major. On what basis are we deciding whether or not something transfers? And if that, and if we have that basis, then on what basis would we change what we want to do? Because presumably we had a good reason for accepting or not accepting transfer credits before. And I'm not sure that I like the idea of changing in a way that somehow seems to be lowering our standards here.
Okay. Reiner, do you want to address that? And then I can, and Cecile wants to comment, but.
No, I like Cecile to deal.
Okay.
I may be completely misunderstanding something here, but I was wondering how many of these substitutions are already being used when students transfer in, when students go through the registrar's office. Don't they get?
No, that is the point. For example, you've taken a history class.
Right.
Okay. It doesn't count towards meeting our History 100 core requirement unless it meets very specific requirements. Those are listed right here what the current requirement is.
Okay.
Okay. For example, American History won't do. Okay. The registrar's office obeys our instructions. Those are our instructions. Your proposal is to change our instructions.
Okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood something.
Paul?
Just a quick comment. I agree that we want to have these data, and I like them, of course, but my experience is this is a big issue that you brought up, and the whole dimension that I actually see it switching into is the whole issue of e-learning, because I have these questions all the time with people coming up with online classes. Either I want to take them here or take them from outside and then want to bring them back. So the whole e-learning discussion, I think, is a really big issue with transfer students, because they transfer classes and credits that way.
No. I have to disagree on that one. I mean, either the class, whether it's e-learning or f-learning or g-learning or h-learning, has specific characteristics, like, for example, a specific kind of history class, or it doesn't. And it really doesn't matter what kind of instruction it was. Either has those characteristics or it doesn't.
Okay. Mark?
So, and we can get you more data on this. I know the School of Management has done with at least 10 students just this semester, having them apply down to UAA, get the core accepted, and transferring back up to here. I asked our staff advisor as I was leaving for this meeting how many. She said at least 10. She thinks maybe more. She's doing two more just today. So it is a big issue. And what we would like at the School of Management is if it's good enough, the core to transfer up from UAA, then it should be the same for all other colleges. And we're getting a lot of the transfer students. It's not only it's not only just the ones you mentioned before, but it's the ones the Chancellor mentioned. There's a lot of them coming back from UAF. There's also people going on to our Homeland Security Emergency Management Program, which we have 110 students, and most of those are outside of Alaska, and that degree is solely online. So it's a big deal for us, and we're being asked to get more and more revenue, and this is one way to get it. And these students, a lot of them are just totally discouraged otherwise, so they have to come in and retake a lot of different courses. So it's certainly something that we support.
And certainly the problem with laundering, I think, is not laundering per se. It's that some students are in the know and figure out the system and launder, and other students don't figure it out and wind up being penalized for not knowing the system.
Are there any other comments? Hannah?
Well, I still feel that at some level we ought to be looking at standards and the requirements that we as UAF want to have, right? And I'm not against such a proposal, but I'd like to see some kind, sort of like what Amy was suggesting, some kind of data. Why did we require this in the first place? Are we getting the kinds of students coming in with those requirements when we accept them? And what would happen if we suddenly, take whatever is being proposed? I don't know, but I'd like to know.
Well, in a sense, we've done that for years because, again, we take a student from UAA who has done their requirements, which are much more
much less restrictive than ours, and we accept them. We say, okay, fine, you've done the equivalent because you've accepted your requirements. I know of no studies which would show whether students who've transferred from UAA do better, worse, or the same as any other student. I don't know how well you would acquire that information.
Any other comments or questions? Reiner, is there any other way that you would like for... Oh, I'm sorry, Chris, go ahead. I just didn't see you. Like I said.
Yeah, I just want to second again Amy's request for some data and also to say a little bit more in support of what Anna has said about the need for us to think about what it is that we're trying to get students to get out of general education. When the core was set up, it was set up for a reason. That's now under reconsideration, which is fine, but it seems like this is moving a little too quickly in terms of shifting the ground under the core before it actually is done by the process of the GERC committee. So I also see a process issue as being embedded in this. And, you know, transfer students are one issue, but what is the spirit of the core that we're trying to get them to complete? And it's interesting, I've been a part of the core discussions for a while now. This issue of substituting American history for world history always comes up. America is not the world. And so that's just it's a pretty strong example of why it is that, you know, there is a core with certain requirements on it right now. If we change those requirements, it's one thing. But so long as they're still in place, I don't know that it's a good idea to put into place additional mechanisms for circumventing that original intent until it's rethought.
Well, there are the arguments. Jane, if we could get up a discussion board set up that people could continue putting in comments and stuff, that would be great. Thank you.
Excellent, Reiner. That answers the question I was about to ask you. Thank you. Okay. Is Chris Lott here? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and say we're going to put off our break a little bit so that you can give a presentation. That's okay, I think. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So I will try to be brief knowing that you have your break coming. And I want to say thanks for the time. Thanks to Theo and Dave for the invitation to talk a little bit about e-learning and innovation. I wanted to talk about three things very quickly. But to provide some context, the site that's up there you can get to through a link that's going to be provided to all of you. There's also a handout at the back table. It will look different when you go there now because I didn't realize there was an ad there, and as much as I'd like you to take advantage of the overstock sale, I'd rather you looked at our resources. So if you follow that link, you can get to all of this stuff. I wanted to talk about three things. One is UAF e-learning. And a few things about what we do for faculty, because we've had a lot of changes in our organization over the last few years. Two, innovation and what we're talking about when we talk about innovation, because that's a focus of ours, of many focuses that we have. And three, the Chancellor's Fellows program that started this semester and that we would like to see engagement with all of you and support from all of you and ideas from you. So first, UAF e-learning, as you may or may not know, changed about a year ago now to reporting to the Chancellor's office. And as part of that, we revised the way that we work with departments. So we now work with departments on a collaborative basis. We don't offer e-learning classes of our own. We support departments, schools, and colleges in offering your classes. The tuition sharing, the model that we use makes it across the board just your classes, and decisions are made regardless of the modality. So the collaborative nature of what we do has changed. At the same time, we've also continued to enhance our services for all faculty, and it's important to note that with UAF e-learning, we do not only support online classes. We support technology faculty development, technology-oriented development across the board for all UAF faculty, no matter what you want to use or do. We don't necessarily have all in-house expertise for everything. We do what we can to connect people with resources. So if you're working with a face-to-face class, you want to enrich it, you want to use the web, you want to use some technology to enhance the curriculum, we can help with that. If you want to look at flipping, hybridization, whatever the current term of the day might be with your class, we can help with that. If you're looking at complete online e-learning opportunities, we can help with that. So we encourage anybody to contact us at e-learning, phone, email, web, smoke signals, Google Chat, whatever the case might be for you, and just say, hey, I'm doing this, what can you do to help? And we have a team of instructional designers to help do that. And I will note that I think we should all be grateful for the design team that you have here at UAF. I've had the real pleasure of working with people across the country that have jobs similar to mine and do things like mine, and I cannot say how many times I've been asked about how we manage to have a team like this, how they can take this team away from me, if at all possible. It is the envy of many institutions, and I think for you as faculty to take advantage of it, that's why we're here, and we'd really like to hear from more of you. We also help facilitate and do clinics and trainings, the iTeach clinics you might have heard of, faculty on tap sessions where we just help stimulate conversation, because in the end, the faculty are leading us. We're there to support you, and the more faculty work together and share with us, the better. We have three focuses on the design team that I run: faculty development, course development, and innovation and technology exploration. So I'm not going to talk about course development because that's part of another conversation, working with departments, schools, and colleges. But when it comes to innovation and technology and faculty development, that's you, and that's the service we're trying to provide to you. One of the things that happens in institutions is that innovation can be very hard to manage within academic institutions or any large-scale institution. It's a well-studied phenomenon about innovation. There's a term called disruptive innovation, which is what we focus on in terms of a theory to think about what we can do within UAF to help promote and foster innovation from faculty. If you aren't familiar with disruptive innovation, I chose not to put up slides with images, so I'm just going to describe to you very, very briefly. You have what is called sustaining innovations, and that's something that institutions are really good at. Big companies are good at that. If you were to graph out the progress over time, it's this linear kind of 45-degree line. Okay, institutions are good at that. You do what you do. You know how to do it. You get a little bit better at it each year, hopefully. You take the processes and you refine them. It's incremental. Disruptive innovations are different. They have a very steep slope. They go from 0 to 60 very quickly, and typically what happens is disruptive innovations mess with the sustaining innovations. They mess with what's happening. They upset the balance. And while the secret sauce of having disruptive innovation driving an institution is not yet been found, the context has been studied, and we know very well what it looks like to be a disruptive innovator and what it looks like to support that kind of innovation. So in order to both support sustaining innovations, which we know how to do, we also want to identify disruptive innovators. We want to try really new things. One example of disruptive innovation happening in academia right now are MOOCs, the big bad MOOCs. They are something that is challenging many of the things that institutions do on a day-to-day basis. I have recently sent out a teaching tip that hopefully all of you have seen or have the chance to see that come out weekly talking about MOOCs. So I don't want to debate their qualities or not here. I'm a bit of a skeptic myself, but the idea here with disruptive innovation is that things like that challenge what we do and give us opportunities to try new things. In that vein, we've identified a group of faculty that are called the SITE Fellows, the Chancellor's Program for Innovation in Technology and E-Learning, and those are 8 faculty members that were nominated by deans and then selected by us based on the projects that they had in mind, the interests they had, their willingness to make a commitment. And then we support those faculty in what I like to call, except it can be scary sometimes to people above, instructive failure and the possibility of innovative activity. So trying something that is really dear to them, that's new, that they might not have support for, that a team of instructional designers can get together with them and support them for 3 semesters in doing something new. We don't know if these things are going to work necessarily. Some of them will probably fail. If you don't fail, sometimes you're probably not innovating. But at eLearning, that's okay. We want to provide a safe context to do that. So far we've had an innovation boot camp where we got the 8 selected fellows together. They got to meet each other. We got to establish some community. They got to meet instructional designers. And then they are now kind of paired up, or I don't know what we would call tripled up, depending on their projects, and they're going on field trips and they're discussing what they're really going to be working on. We hope to have and will have interactions and meetings with administration, with more faculty. The idea is threefold with the Innovation Fellows, and this is a service that we really wanted to provide directly to faculty that hasn't been seen on this campus before. One is that as an site fellow, we want to support you in doing something new. So that's the project. 2, we want to support you in publication in whatever form that might be. So maybe it's conference presentations, maybe it's typical peer-reviewed publications, whatever that is. And that looks very different in today's day and age sometimes. And then three is to be a mentor for incoming faculty and new fellows, as well as working and providing faculty development for larger groups sharing what's happening. It's an idea to elevate the prestige, the leadership, and the understanding of what faculty do on this campus, because we have some really amazing and innovative faculty working that people just aren't aware of. We have at least one site fellow here, Rorick, and what happens whenever you get faculty together in a room is they don't even know what this person that they may be seeing every day is doing. So we hope with site fellows to elevate kind of that relationship. So what I'd like to leave you with here in terms of this triad is, one, e-learning isn't just for people teaching online classes. We have a great team. I'd like you to take advantage of them. You can go to the e-learning website, go to this link that's been provided. It's easy to find us. And that runs the gamut of faculty development. We have done many workshops, online clinics, face-to-face clinics, whatever you need for departments, programs, small groups, et cetera. So that component is there for all of you, and we hope you take advantage of it, because why not use this team that's there? Second, we want to support innovation, so if you have something new, let us help you. Third, look for the activities of the site fellows. Look for the e-learning activities that we provide. I teach clinics, Teaching Tips Live, Teaching Tips, Tech Fest strands, the site fellows activities, the site fellows presentations. We do, I think when I just reported on this, in the last year we did 127 discrete faculty development events around campus oriented around technology and education, almost all of which are open either just to attend or to apply to attend if it's a limited invite. So that's what we're trying to do to support faculty innovation, support faculty on campus. It's the faculty development end of e-learning. It's not something that everybody is completely aware of. And if you have questions about it, I'm happy to entertain a couple now or let you go to your break and look at the resources. Is that brief enough? I hope. I tried
that. That was great. Thank you very much, Chris. Do you have questions for Chris?
I just want to add something here. Being one of the participants, I think I've told you that I'm participating in this process. I'm sort of narrowing in on my project, and what I will do is sort of keep talking about it throughout the year, about the events, but also about my project, and get input, maybe get people who want to work with me. Rorick, when you're here, maybe you can do this. I'll invite you to do the same thing. So just to get involved and maybe have conversations about innovation in the classroom.
This is a campus with a lot of innovative faculty, and it's a shame, I think, that it isn't, the awareness isn't higher, and we'd like to help recognize that where we can.
And as I've said before, if we're not vocal about the innovations that we are instituting, there is a perception that there isn't anything happening sometimes. And so we really kind of need to, I think, be visible and vocal about those things to kind of create a different climate and culture that innovation happens from the faculty level and doesn't have to come from the top.
Okay. Mark, then Amy.
So I just had a quick question. If we wanted to do something with this, is our department charged for your services? Or?
No. We provide free consultation and services for all faculty. Of course, if it becomes something that's very extended, then we want to look for ways to have that relationship. Sometimes that comes in the form of developing courses for e-learning. Sometimes things are just of interest because we have this mandate for supporting innovation and supporting faculty. So there's no charge to come and get help. If it becomes extended, we just work out how to do that.
Amy?
So, what I don't understand is how we, as faculty who use different types of technology in our classes that would be live, so not classes that have been traditionally hosted by what was CDE and now e-learning, you're saying you want to be our resource for that, correct?
Yes, I'm saying...
What I don't understand is how do we know if we call, so if we use Blackboard, how do we know when we, I guess I don't understand what the suite of resources would be and who we would call when related to all of the different technologies that we use in our live classes.
Sure. I think the easiest answer to that, what I'm saying basically is if you're using technology in the classroom or technology to support education, we are the stop. And we then can help make that determination for you because we know the resources working collaboratively with OIT and the Faculty Development Office. So the easiest answer is to call us and then let us help make those connections for you because if it is something that OIT is offering support for in a more direct or easy way, we work with them and we want you to take advantage of that. OIT provides a lot of training and that's a great foundation for the faculty development process. But coming to us is probably the easiest way to short circuit the bounce that you might get trying to figure out where to go with the question or the technology. And yeah, whether it's face-to-face, being supported with Blackboard or in-classroom technologies or web supplementation and enrichment, whatever those are, we provide support for all of that. And we also know what else is happening on campus, so we're a good connection point for that. So if you come to us with Blackboard, we may say, oh, here's something that OIT is doing that can help you as well. Here's a person working with Chris Becks on certain problems, or here's things we'll do to support you. We also provide self-help resources in the form of iTeachU and information about all of our faculty developments and the links there. So some things you can go to iTeachU and just get direct help with already because we've answered these questions before if you want that kind of self-help resource.
OIT and Chris Becks and Blackboard and everybody understand now that you're the first stop.
Yes. I mean, they understand that when it comes to the faculty development for the campus as opposed to the training for the campus, that we're the place to go. And we work closely with them. We have, in the case of Blackboard, a person who's a specialist in that who works with Chris Becks. So, yes, they will direct you to us and we will direct you to them as it makes sense. We're not in competition with one another. There's too much to do to worry about competition. We're really in trying to find all the ways we can to collaborate and do all the time.
Laura?
I'm a little bit foggy on the how do evaluations work in this e-learning.
Okay. Evaluation, classroom evaluations?
Yes.
Yeah, we have
both, actually. So one, the peer evaluations that are part of many unit criteria as well as student evaluations.
Yeah, so because the courses that we offer are department courses, the peer evaluation and the evaluation models you might have within your department, those are handled by your department and your academic structure, your dean, the provost. We don't do peer evaluation unless it's something on a voluntary basis where it's literally peer evaluation of courses where faculty say, I want somebody to look at this and help me. In-class evaluations, so to speak, the course evaluations, we have two. All our classes have a mid-course three-question set that's just a real-time thing asking, did you get prompt response? I can share these questions with you if you'd like. But the end of course evaluation is the same as this SOI type evaluations you have in the classroom with a supplement of questions designed specifically for e-learning. And that's based exactly on, and I should say, it's based on the model of the SOIs because there are many different evaluations that are in use. But we use a standard evaluation and that is shared directly with the faculty member. They get their results just like you would in the classroom. It's also shared with the dean and or department chair depending on how that is asked for by the dean.
How do you ensure compliance with that? So, I mean, it's hard enough when you are in person there handing them out. If it's like some foggy thing online, what's the actual response there?
Yeah, no, we are continuing to try to find ways to improve response because, yeah, you're right. It's not like the face-to-face class where you sit it in front of them and they have to complete it. So we do incentives with drawings for tuition waivers. We do things about revealing and showing it and educating the faculty to make sure the students know that they're there so that we can continue to improve the uptake rate. But it is an option, just like it's an option in face-to-face classes, even though most students don't either understand that or take that option not to do it.
You know, I have to say in many ways, I think for a young tenure-track faculty, this very much concerns me because we are evaluated on these kind of things, and it seems very, very ambiguous to me on how evaluation on both ends are going to take place here.
I'm going to just jump in really quick here because we're having sort of two conversations. One is, of course, what Chris just talked about with respect to e-learning resources for us. The other being instructional evaluation turning into an online effort. That conversation is a much broader one that that Eric Madsen and Franz Meyer have together worked on quite a bit last year.
That's not what I mean, though. I mean specifically for e-learning. I know about the other effort,
okay.
For e-learning too, I think this is just one of those things that kind of falls under the radar as being something, not our problem.
Well, our philosophy is we can't require students to do the evaluation just like you can't require them to do it in the classroom. You can't follow up and be sure that they filled it out. So the best we can do is provide the survey mechanism for them and keep it in line with what campus is offering. Now, when that larger movement is done and we have figured out a system for campus that presumably include the online assessment. We will tie right in, just use that same system that you're using in the classroom for our courses. But I suspect that just like across the country, I've never heard otherwise, online students doing non-compulsory surveys and assessments is going to have a lower return rate than face-to-face for obvious logistical reasons. So it is up to the academic structure departments, the provost, whatever processes there are to decide how to take that into account. We just provide the tools and surveys for the students.
So could you speak real briefly, too, about where the tuition is or who the tuition is benefiting? So I understand that 50% probably goes to the department. So where does the other 50% go versus normal classes?
Yeah, we have a tuition sharing model where part of the tuition goes to e-learning and part of the tuition goes to the schools and colleges. And the same way that it does with face-to-face instruction, that model is exactly there. And I have to be honest, I'm not the expert in the fiscal model. Brian probably could answer that better than me or the provost.
So regardless of whether a class is taught online or in person, 60% goes to the department. The other 40% goes to support costs. If it's in person, a lot of it goes to facilities. If it's online, a lot of it goes to the e-learning and distance education. That varies for students affiliated with one of the community campuses because there's campus support provided there.
Okay, then I have a huge concern here. So considering that, are we ever going to get light switches in our buildings then? I mean, because if now all of a sudden 40% is going to e-learning, we become like this online, you know, everybody on their own computer plays, and so these 40% are now not going to facility services to support where we work.
Well, certainly you can at the department level choose not to offer e-learning classes and only offer in-person. By the change that we made, we moved to where it's a departmental decision as to where the workload will go. There is not a direct relationship to light switches, but there is to technology support overall.
Any other questions or comments for Chris? Thank you.
Just a brief clarification. As Chris mentioned, it's not just about distance courses. So e-learning provides support that goes beyond distance courses. And so for any course you teach to get some input on how to incorporate technology in innovative ways does not mean that then 40% of the revenue of that course automatically goes to e-learning.
Yeah,
did I get that right?
Yes, we want to support and do support classes of all kinds. There are many reasons why people may or may not offer online courses. Our idea and philosophy is to use the rich technologies we have around us to make courses better no matter how they're delivered. In many face-to-face classes, that is involved in time shifting, so you spend less time lecturing with your students and more time engaging with them by shifting some of that material off, also called flipping the classroom, or just using some of the technology out there to provide materials in a more straightforward way or use Blackboard in a way that's more efficient, anything like that. So the question about how and why courses may or may not be offered via e-learning is a different issue. I'm just here to say that regardless of that decision, if you have use or need for technology or would like support, that's one of the things that we provide to all faculty. That's what I'm here to share.
Okay, Falk?
Yeah, if I just make a small comment then regarding IAS scores and tenure process and so on. I think what we really experience is a lack of culture in the tenure process, in the departmental evaluations to deal with e-learning in a certain way. And I think that's a big issue. So I appreciate that you're here and presented to us, but I can report to you from my experience, there are huge cultural hindrances or whatever. We're still not there yet to even embrace e-learning just from the faculty perspective. And there are many reasons why that is, including the IAS scores and so on. But just the way how to interpret the results, how to value this, how to appreciate this. I can tell you again from what I see, we are not there yet, and I think we need to work harder, but this is a big cultural issue too.
Yeah, and we have been working hard and continue on providing the data, what departments and schools and colleges end up doing with that, which is where that issue really lies. And certainly there's a lot of progress to be made, and we'll continue to fight that fight as well.
Okay, I'm going to thank you again.
for doing that. I apologize for the bad planning on my part with respect to the timing of the break. We are butting up against, we don't have that much more in the way of meeting, but we do have some, and I still want to defer to people's biology and let you take a quick break. So please be back at about 2:35 so we can wrap up new business when you can concentrate. Thank you.
Where's my agenda?
Got any students we have?
Just hang here.
That's the old one. All right. Hang on. Okay, a little bit. Okay.
Okay. Welcome back. Sorry for the short break. We have two items of new business to consider. The first one is a proposal from the SADA committee, and it's concerning mostly changing catalog language to reflect the English policy that's been agreed to. And she's running away. No, she's not. Okay. And that committee's been working on attempting to update the catalog language and our policy to reflect the agreement that we have reached with the other two universities in the system. And Cindy Hardy, do you want to find a microphone? And you can come up here if you'd like. It looks like Chancellor ran away, so.
So, is this on? Okay. Can you hear me?
Speak louder into the mic.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So this motion and the math motion that we passed at the previous Senate meeting are linked in that they both have to do with revisions to the placement section in the catalog. This motion comes as a result of meetings that were held last year between the UAA, UAF, UAS to, and this was at the impetus of statewide, Dana Thomas was instrumental in putting this together, to align placement into English courses between the three universities. The end result of that was an agreement that we would all align our ACCUPLACER levels. And basically what happened was Anchorage had a much higher placement level into English 111 than we did. And so our placement changes effectively raised the placement level into English 111. They've lowered theirs somewhat. And then the other change that we've done is to combine reading and writing scores or reading and sentence skill scores on ACCUPLACER. I did not include a chart on this. The chart is still a work in progress, and I didn't want necessarily for that to be implemented as part of a motion. But you could contact the Advising Center, or you could contact me to see that if you wanted to. So this motion changes some things in language that reflect current practice and current hoped-for practice in English and developmental English. See, what else can I say about this? Some of it overlaps with the math motion that we passed last meeting, and there was a little bit of tinkering with language from that motion just to clarify it. None of that affected policy. I guess I'll take questions.
Okay, are there any questions for Cindy?
And it's totally innocuous, and you won't regret voting in favor of it.
Is that a question or a comment?
That was a comment.
Well, let me comment one more thing on make one more comment on what the effective consequences of this are. And one is that we will be, in terms of replacement requirement, enforcing the reading requirement with lower-level developmental English requirements. So when a student places in the lowest level of developmental English, they will also be required to take the lowest or comparable reading course. And the second level, which is currently DEVE 070, but which we agreed last year to change to 104, that'll be changing in the fall. That course will also have the DEVS-105, which is a reading class attached to it. So we're really strengthening the reading-writing connection. In the developmental ed department, we're working on developing some combined classes that will reduce the number of credits that students need to take to achieve the same goal. You'll see that later on. Not today. partly it's really trying to be thoughtful about how students, what students need to have to be successful, what we're hearing from faculty about what students don't have in terms of reading and writing ability, that of those students who come in at the developmental level, and working in collaboration with the English department on that.
Okay, so I need somebody to move. That can be you if you want, Cindy, and then second this motion so we can discuss it.
So moved.
Oh, that's right, you can. Thank you. So I need, so moved, and do I have a second? Thank you, Jane. Okay, so discussion, questions, comments for Cindy on this, or discussion among ourselves. Reiner says vote for it. It's innocuous. We won't regret it. Could either go with that or read it.
Can I mention one more thing?
Of course.
Thank you. Under course prerequisites, I'm just trying to look over this and think about what are the controversial items that we've discussed. The sentence that says students who take a course at a higher level than a corresponding prerequisite course. Then a corresponding prerequisite course required for a degree program are not exempt from taking that required course. The intent of that is that a student who takes, an example I thought of in terms of English, if a student takes English 271, a creative writing course, English 111 is prerequisite for that, but an instructor might choose to let a student in for good reasons. That does not exempt that student from then taking the English 111. We had some discussions about a similar situation in math. I think it's a little more rare in math, but say a student takes, for some reason, a science course, they're not exempted from taking that math requirement that was a prerequisite, even if an instructor lets them into a higher level course.
Okay, any other discussion? Concerns, Amy?
Brief comment. I just think you all have done a good job in this, and I just like what you said, Cindy. I know it's coming later, that you're working in the developmental area to reduce the number of classes they have to take and still get sort of the similar developmental results, and I think that's so important for those people moving through that developmental process to get them into the other courses. So I just wanted to say I think that sounds great.
Yeah, and I guess we're doing two things, and obviously with all these things you have to go step by step. So the first thing we're doing is working on taking the 6 credits of our lowest level and reducing them to 5, which is a small increment, but those are the students at the most at risk. And at the next level, reducing 6 credits to 4. We'll see how it goes. But the other thing that we're talking about as a department is methods where our hope would be if somebody took the 060 and the 052, the reading and writing together, that they would be so wonderfully transformed that they might be able to skip a level. So we're talking about how we might be able to respond to that for students.
Okay. Any others? Are we ready to vote?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. It wasn't rhetorical. Okay, I haven't heard any objections, so I'm going to just ask at this point, without objection, let's just go ahead and vote, darn it. All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And abstentions, which I always forget to ask for. Okay, motion carries unanimously. Our last item of new business. Last month, you may recall that we received a document from the President's office
through the Provost and Chancellor about the next stage of SDI, now known as Shaping Alaska's Future. And we were asked to comment on it. The various universities in the UA system were asked to generate feedback on it. Our university has commented. The Faculty Alliance has given some feedback to the President's office concerning the document and the process. And we had a discussion online of the Faculty Senate, which we used in thinking about how we wanted to respond. We've written a resolution from the Faculty Senate that we are considering today that would constitute essentially our formal feedback, that is the formal feedback from the UAF Faculty Senate concerning our recommendation concerning the way forward, given the discussion that we've had about the Shaping Alaska's Future document. So that is attachment number 195/3. It's short. And I'm finding it. There's a bunch of whereases in which we attempt to explain the rationale and the background for why we offer the resolution that we do, but in essence, the resolution recommends three things: that there be a new revised Shaping Alaska's Future document published for comment prior to March 15th. That the second recommendation is that faculty of every UA institution be given meaningful opportunity to review and provide feedback to the draft Shaping Alaska's Future document. And third, that the target date for completion of the Shaping Alaska's Future, the final document, be delayed until the June 2014 meeting of the UA Board of Regents. Okay, so I need a motion to adopt this resolution and a second, please.
So moved.
Thank you, Reiner. Thank you, Chris. Okay, discussion, feedback, comments, questions. Yes.
I just have a quick question. It was my understanding there was going to be another draft put out in December with a very quick review time. Has that changed? Or are we asking for a change?
Can I ask the Provost to comment on that?
To the best of my current knowledge, there will not be another draft put out in December. There was originally a very quick turnaround date for the various constituencies, such as the Chancellor's Cabinet, so the three institutions and the Faculty Alliance, to submit comments. And that was then with the stated intent of producing another draft sometime before the close of the semester, roughly. But at this point, based on the input that the statewide administration received, I believe they understand that they need to do a more substantive effort in terms of revising the original draft. And the plan that, as far as I know right now, is for Vice President Thomas to produce a revision, and for that revision to be discussed by the System-Wide Academic Council before it's then created into another draft that is considered for circulation broadly. And as you can see from that multi-step process, that's probably going to be January before it gets there at the very earliest.
Thank you. So is he going to be accepting input from people, or, I mean, rather than comments on a full-fledged draft?
Well, he already received all of the input that was originally submitted the 18th of November, I think it was the original deadline. When they have the new draft circulated, there will be some kind of process for review of that draft. That hasn't been discussed at all, and I have no idea what they're planning. But I believe this resolution in part is intended to shape that review process of Shaping Alaska's Future.
Any other comments, questions? Does this mean you all hate it, or does this mean you all like it? Yeah, Anna.
Sorry, I'll make one more quick. I just want to make a general statement that I didn't become aware of how actually important this was until recently.
And I would urge everyone to at least look at it and be prepared for the next round of comments. But I'm happy to support this one and make a motion to I don't know what the procedure is, but whatever.
So the procedure at this point is that we're considering a resolution from this body to essentially feedback to the statewide administration says, here's what we think is important for you to consider as you go forward. So vote yes. Other comments or questions? Are we ready to vote?
Yes.
I think we are. Okay. All right. All those in favor of the resolution, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say nay. Any abstentions? The resolution carries unanimously. Thank you, everyone. At this point, we're ready for governance reports. Brad, do you have a report from staff council?
Good afternoon. As you might be able to guess, the proposal to cut the employee education benefit is of major concern to staff council. At our November meeting, we unanimously passed a resolution supporting the tuition waiver as it currently stands and opposing any changes. And we'll be looking to get as many people in the room a week from this Thursday for public comment as possible to speak to the benefit. And I appreciate any faculty who are there or who would like to speak to it too. It's very heartening to me. Other things, we'll be looking to, of course, the budget discussions, to the governor's budget, and thinking about what that means for us going forward. Paying attention to shaping Alaska's future. I appreciate the resolution you just passed. I was definitely of the opinion that the first draft was
needed work.
it came through so quickly that I don't know if we had time to even look at it. I think we had a 3-day turnaround in my department to get comments back, and I heard similar things from some other staff. We'll also be looking at paying attention to the WIN Healthy Roads, what the wellness program is going to look like, if it's available in January 2014 or if it's going to be farther ahead. And then one last bit of item, maybe old news. In October, Staff Alliance passed a resolution to the president asking bullying training, which had been given to statewide employees, to be brought down to all the MAUs. The president agreed. And we heard from Chancellor Rogers that UAF is waiting on what the training is actually going to look like. I don't know if that would go to all employees, but it sounded like it would certainly go to staff that you may supervise.
Thank you, Brad. And any questions or comments for Brad? Jane?
Brad, I didn't quite get what were you saying about healthy roads.
Oh, I would be the wrong person to give a full update on that, but the short version is that the wellness program is up in the air.
Actually, at the JHCC meetings, November 21st and 22nd, we were told that Healthy Roads is now the wellness vendor and should start in January.
Sorry, I guess I misspoke. Yes, that first part is I understood that too, that they are moving forward with Healthy Roads. What I'd understood was that it was still in limbo as to when it would be rolled out.
Yeah, and it is, but they're hoping January.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, we'll see. I'm guessing not.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but that's the hope. Thanks.
All right, thanks. Great points. All right, any other questions or comments for Brad?
Could you just tell us the time and place of the meeting on Thursday again real quick?
The Board of Regents
yeah.
meeting? It's December 12th and 13th, and I think the agenda should be out today.
Oh, okay.
But I think public comment is usually 8:30 to 9:30, but I think it varies based on some board meetings. But when the agenda is out, and it should be on the Board of Regents website, then that would be the final word.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody from ASUAF at this point? How about Danny from Athletics? All right. United Academics, Falk? Okay. Okay. Jane from UAFT?
No, I was just going to mention the same thing Brad did about healthy roads.
All right, excellent. Okay, time now for public comment. Anyone from the public wishing to make a comment to the Senate? Yes.
I have a comment from the Research Advisory Committee, REC, and I'm not sure all the senators are aware, but there's a Board of Regents mandate that has been put on UEF to do a UEF-wide research program review. That research program view is going to hit basically all the units within UAF. It's also done at UAA. And RAC is looking into the process. The chancellor has tasked the vice chancellor of research, Mark Myers, to put up a task force for this. I'm as the chair of RAC. I'm part of that task force. It's led by Larry Hintzman at IARC. And if you have any questions about that process, you're welcome to approach me. We just had one meeting. We're trying to figure out what this research review UEF-wide will entail, and we're going to take it from there. The sub-comment to that is that as the new chair of RAC, I'm also soliciting new members. We don't have a full representation in RAC from all major units at UEF, so we would like to increase our committee to have a fair and representative committee members from all major units at UEF. So that's being solicited next week from us.
All right, great. Thank you. Yes, Amy.
So maybe this is something I'll follow up with you, but this is everybody, right? So social sciences and humanities.
Anything with the research.
Research. Yes. So this will become very interesting how they decide to count research, right? I mean, that must be on your radar. So I don't know where my questions are. It's just this is the first I've heard of this. And so will this task force seek people from the social sciences and the humanities who might consider their work research, or do we need to talk to our members and have them contact you? In other words, what's the best way to ensure that down here we have a voice in terms of displaying what would be considered research or an equivalent of research?
Those are all great questions. I think this is a really complicated process. I give you an example. UEF-wide, we're going to review research, but there's different hats. So I'm tripartite, for instance. So I have part research, part service, part teaching, and then you are going to put that against someone who's all research. So there's one example of complexities in this process. I think the task force is more there to put down some sort of ground rules how we can do this in an efficient way and take into account all these different issues. You're welcome to bring anything to me, and I'll bring it up to the task force.
Right.
That's the short answer.
And just this is about reviewing program areas, research program areas, not individual.
It's not the individual, down to individual level, and I think the task force, after our one meeting, is moving towards clustering to larger scale units and a lot of self-evaluation in the process.
But that, to me, I'm sorry, makes this even more important that there is a display of what different unit, that people understand that this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. It's off the top.
Yep.
Can I make a comment on that?
Anna, yeah. Yes, and then Knut.
Just speaking to Amy and anyone else here, I'm also on RAC. I'm not on the task force. I am on RAC, and I'm representing CLA. So if anyone in CLA wants to let me know about their research concerns, please let me know.
Okay, thank you, Anna. Knut?
Peter, just I know we're running late here, but could you briefly remind us what the motivation for this review was and what is the purported goal of this exercise?
I think, Susan, do you want to?
I might be a little bit more familiar with it than most. At their last retreat in January, the Board of Regents, at one part of the meeting, met with the chancellors, And they pointed out to the chancellors that Board of Regents policy all along has required a program review process for every activity at the university. We've always done it for academic programs, or at least done it for a long time, for decades, for academic programs. But now it is extended not only to research, but also to outreach, to student services, to administrative services. Basically, all activities of the university are supposed to be examined for quality, for cost effectiveness. The outcome is that if a program is shown not to be cost effective and not to be of good quality, it either should be required to be improved or it would be stopped if there was if it was the sort of program or activity that could be stopped. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
My answer to you, Knut, is that I think we're formulating that as a part of this process, and I think we're going to try to frame it in a positive sense, not to try to have units butt heads with each other, but look at trends within units and try to make it something positive. The last thing is that we're also going to suggest that we review the research support program. Because if you want to be a successful research unit, it sometimes hinges on the support you get. So we want to propose that we also review the research support within this context.
Can I ask for a quick one? So how are you making or drawing the line between academics and research? I mean, you know, we all know that they're kind of pretty...
We're going to have try for as little cross-fertilization as possible. But it's a tricky one. As like I mentioned, you and I are tripartite, and there are people who are 100% research. So there has to be some normalization in this process. That's what we're looking.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Any other public comments? Okay, members' comments? And any committee chairs want to update us with something that that needs oral reinforcement of what's in the back of the agenda? Okay, seeing none, we are 4 minutes late, but we are.